Welcome to Treasure the Word. Here are some insights on Mark 14. The hour has come. 2 days before Passover, while the chief priests and teachers of the law are looking for a sly way to arrest and kill Jesus, a woman, identified elsewhere as Mary of Bethany, breaks open an alabaster jar of expensive perfume, pure nard worth more than a year's wages, and pours the entire jar over Jesus' head. Some of those present are indignant. This could have been sold, and the money given to the poor. Jesus rebukes them and defends her. She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. Truly I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. 14:8-9. It is worth sitting with why this moment provoked such sharp disapproval and why Jesus defended it so strongly. The objection sounds reasonable on its face. Genuine needs of the poor set against a single, extravagant, unrepeatable act of devotion. But Jesus' response suggests that not every act of costly devotion needs to be justified by its practical usefulness. Mary's gift was not calculated generosity. It was worship, offered to the only person in history who was worth that much and infinitely more. There is a difference between calculating what is the most efficient use of resources and simply pouring out something valuable because of who is receiving it. Both kinds of giving have their place in a Christian's life, and Scripture elsewhere commands real, sacrificial generosity toward the poor. But this scene reminds us that worship is not always required to justify itself in terms of usefulness. Sometimes the only fitting response to Christ's worth is simply to give him what is costly, without asking what else it might have accomplished. Immediately after this act of devotion, Mark places its stark opposite. Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, goes to the chief priests to betray Jesus, and they are delighted to promise him money, 14:10-11. Devotion and betrayal, side by side in the same chapter, in the same house, a reminder that proximity to Jesus guarantees nothing about the state of a person's heart. At the Passover meal, Jesus takes bread, breaks it, and says, "Take it, this is my body." Then he takes a cup, gives thanks, and says, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many," 14:22-24. In instituting what the church would come to call the Lord's Supper, Jesus reinterprets the ancient Passover meal, itself a memorial of Israel's deliverance from slavery in Egypt through the blood of a lamb around himself. He is the true Passover lamb, and his blood about to be poured out will accomplish a greater deliverance than Egypt ever pictured. Deliverance from sin itself. The echo of Mark 10:45 is unmistakable, a ransom for many, and here blood poured out for many. The whole gospel has been building toward this meal. After supper, in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus takes Peter, James, and John further into the garden and tells them he is deeply distressed and troubled, his soul overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death, 14:33-34. He falls to the ground and prays that, if possible, the hour might pass from him. And then, in the same breath, "Yet not what I will, but what you will," 36. This single sentence captures the heart of Jesus' whole life and ministry. He came to do the Father's will, and here, at the point of greatest cost, that commitment does not waver, even though it is clearly not easy. The sorrow, the sweat, the repeated, urgent prayer make plain that this submission cost him everything a human soul can feel. 3 times he returns to find the disciples asleep, and 3 times he tells them to watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation, adding, with evident understanding of human frailty, "The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak," 14:38. There is something instructive in Jesus' own pattern here. Real spiritual battles are often fought, at least in part, on very physical ground: fatigue, comfort, the pull toward rest when watchfulness is called for. The discipline of staying alert and prayerful in the hour that matters most does not come naturally to any of us. It did not come naturally, in their weakness, even to Jesus' closest disciples. Judas arrives with an armed crowd sent by the religious leaders, identifies Jesus with a kiss, and Jesus is arrested. Everyone deserted him and fled. Every disciple who, only hours before at supper, had insisted they would never fall away. Peter alone follows at a distance, into the courtyard of the high priest, and there, exactly as Jesus had predicted, denies even knowing Jesus three times before the rooster crows a second time. When Peter realizes what he has done, he breaks down and weeps, 14:72. Peter's collapse is not really Peter's alone. He is simply the most visible example, since Mark tells us plainly that all the disciples fled when Jesus was arrested. It would be easy, reading this account, to feel superior to Peter, to imagine we would have stood firm where he failed. But the honest and more humbling reading is to recognize ourselves in him, quick to make bold promises of loyalty, and just as capable, under real pressure, of falling short of them. What redeems Peter's story, and what makes it worth telling at all, is not that his failure was somehow less serious than it appears, but that his failure was not final. Unlike Judas, Peter would be restored, and the same grace that restored him is held out to every follower of Jesus who has ever discovered, in some hour of testing, that the flesh really is weaker than the Spirit's good intentions. Thank you for spending this time in Mark 14. Until next time, keep treasuring the Word.